On Tuesday, I noticed this and found this quite odd. The top two news stories of the day in BC, on whether it was on Twitter or on newscasts that evening, the first was Graham James. You remember hearing about this all week. He of course, had pleaded guilty to like hundreds of instances of sexual assault on two teenage boys that he was the minor hockey coach of. He had previously been sentenced to 18 months in prison for sexual assault on three other boys, but this time he was, you know, convicted again or pled guilty again, and the court was even told that he was likely to reoffend again. And then on Tuesday he was sentenced to just 2 years in prison with eligibility for full parole by this November. And his own brother then came out in the media and said that this was way too lenient and that he got off easy. So, and then there's that news story. This is Tuesday that it kind of gets announced. And then the other news story that was at the forefront, at least where I was, you know, reading news and things of that, was with that story fresh in context, is the big news item that tanning beds in BC are soon going to be illegal for teenagers. Teenagers won't be able to go to a tanning bed anymore. Due to concerns that and research that has shown that you're more likely to develop skin cancer years later. I'm no fan of tanning beds. I think it's all kind of goofy. But anyway, these two stories are kind of side by side, and I'm pondering them. And I find it interesting that they would go together. You know, it's very important that we protect our teenagers from possibly, you know, excessive tanning and the chance of skin cancer, but it's not really important to protect our teenagers from sexual assault. It was very interesting that these two stories would be side by side in the news that I was watching. And in fact, it made me quite angry that this is considered just. Now, far too often we come across these instances, right? We hear stories, we hear of cases where we're just shocked at what appears to be a complete miscarriage of justice. How could this happen? How could anyone let this be? And you know, we're angry, we're wondering. It's like it just seems all so wrong. And we ask the same questions as we consider the story of Jesus' trial and how could this have happened? How can the innocent be sentenced to death? How can the guilty walk free? This is a complete reversal of justice. This is horrible and evil act. And at the same time, for us, this is the best news possible. So let's take a look at how this plays out. Look at let's back it up to verse 66. When the day came, the assembly of the elders of the people gathered together, both chief priests and scribes, and they led him away to their council, and they said, "If you are the Christ, tell us." But he said to them, "If I tell you, you will not believe, and if I ask you, you will not answer. But from now on, the Son of Man shall be seated at the right hand of the power of God." And they all said, "Are you the Son of God then?" And he said to them, "You say that I am." Then they said, "What further testimony do we need? We've heard it ourselves from his own lips." Well, okay, it's a little confusing because there's actually several trials that happened to Jesus in this section and altogether as we look at all the gospel accounts. Some of them are political, some of them are religious, so it can be tricky to follow what's actually happening. Each gospel writer seems to add little bits and omit others, and so they've each kind of contributing their bit to the story. In fact, at certain points, it seems as though Luke, the way he's kind of collected and communicated, is that he's assuming you've read Mark. He's assuming you're familiar with parts. So there's certain things he just passes by fairly quickly, assuming that you know the backstory, because Mark was written 10 years earlier before Luke wrote. He knows that you're familiar with it, so he kind of assumes it. But when you combine the accounts together to get a fuller version, you see this basic order developing. Jesus is arrested secretly in the middle of the night. He's brought first to Annas, who is he's called the high priest, but he's not actually the high priest anymore. He was the high priest, and now he's just sort of in a supervisor. He's got a lot of influence, but no legal power. It's sort of like how a former president, you still call him Mr. President, even though he's not the president. So he's called the high priest, though he's not actually the high priest anymore. And but he has this significant influence. And so he's the first to sort of investigate and try Jesus. And he conducts this preliminary investigation, and then he sends him off. He has him bound and sends him off to Caiaphas, who's the actual high priest. And Caiaphas conducts then his own pretrial hearing. Meanwhile, throughout the night, during all this, Jesus is mocked, beaten, abused, essentially tortured. And now, these two trials, neither of them are actually official, since according to Jewish law, the high council, the Sanhedrin, could not try a case at night. It was illegal. They could only do it during the daytime. This was a law that was in place to prevent the very thing that they're trying to do right now, a quick and secret trial without public knowledge, to do their dirty work quick and abuse power. So they had to wait until dawn to officially try Jesus, yet the verdict was basically already decided upon overnight. Then what we read here is the council gathers at the crack of dawn, knowing what their decision is already. This is the early morning, Friday morning, the Sanhedrin's gathered, which is led by Caiaphas, the high priest. And now the Sanhedrin is the high council of elders. It's led by the high priest. It governed the people. It was made up of priests, teachers, and the biblical scholars, the lawyers, so to speak. It had both Sadducees, who are predominantly priests, and Pharisees, who are more scholar teachers. And there were 70 of them, plus then the high priest who led it. And it was the highest ruling body. It had been given authority by Rome to decide in any internal matters. They can just kind of self-rule all the internal stuff and will rule the big stuff. They had this authority. Now, it's important to remember that what Luke has given us is just sort of a simple summary. There's more to these conversations than the few words that Luke summarizes with them, but he focuses in kind of on the key points. And now, their interrogation of Jesus here is centered on his identity. Is Jesus the Christ, the Messiah, promised of God? That's the big question that they want to know. It's a religious question. And his answer is sort of yes, sort of no. He affirms that he's a Christ, the Christ, but he's not that kind of Messiah, not the kind that they were picturing, that they were expecting. And as they're questioning them, though, Jesus is not really interested in discussing it. He knows it's a trap. It's a trap. He says, if I tell you, you wouldn't believe. And if I ask, you won't answer. See, you're not interested in learning. So there's no way you'll respond appropriately to the truth anyway. There's nothing I can say to change your mind. It's a trap. Just this week, I saw Pastor Mark Driscoll was on Piers Morgan on his show to talk about his book that he wrote with his wife, Grace, on marriage. And it's the same kind of deal. This is just a trap. It's a televised trap. When Piers Morgan asks you about marriage or homosexuality or the authority of the Bible, this isn't a Bible study, right? He's not trying to learn. He's not trying to grow as a person. He's not trying to understand. It's a trap. It's not a serious question. He's trying to look for a fight, not an answer. It's the same situation here. Jesus knows that this isn't a real trial, you know, where justice is going to be sought and people want to learn what really happened and what the real thing is. This isn't a real conversation. They're not having a Bible study. They don't want to learn the truth or come to an understanding. This is a setup. And so there's no point in bringing clarity where none is welcome, right? And it's like reasoning with a charging bull. Yeah. Even if you could demonstrate your intent and demonstrate your legal right to stand here and that the bull is wrong to be so aggressive in this situation, it doesn't stop the bull. It's coming, right or wrong. It's no respecter of legal authority and personal rights. It's coming, and you can't stop it. And so even though Jesus doesn't really like their wording or their context or what they're really asking, Jesus affirms that, yes, he is the Son of God. And that's all they're looking for. Jesus has testified that he is the Christ. Now, that's not their motive for seeing him killed. They've been motivated by anger and when Jesus called them on their hypocrisy. And they've just grown more and more angry and determined to wipe him out at any cost. But they need a legal reason to appease to Rome to have him executed. That's not something they can just do, kill people. And so they need a legal reason to appeal to Rome. And Jesus testifying that he's the Christ can work this way, because the promised Christ was a kingly figure. It was a true and greater David, leading God's people into a true and greater peace and righteousness, overthrowing God's enemies and leading the nation into this new reign of peace and justice. And so the common expectation was that the Messiah would oppose Caesar, overthrow Rome, and set them free. And so the leadership can use this to say, look, he's a revolutionary. He's against Caesar. He's a rival king looking to overthrow Rome. So is Jesus the Christ? Well, yes, but not that kind. You know, yeah, but not the one that you're expecting. He is a king, but not that kind of king. So he answers, but kind of hesitantly based on what they're trying to drill him on. Now, no one should confuse this, though, for a real trial with you know, justice and truth. This is a kangaroo court. It's a joke. For instance, the same law, the same place in the Talmud where it talks about requiring a daytime trial, it also forbade executing the death penalty on the same day that the sentence was handed down. But Jesus, of course, was arrested in the middle of the night, late into the night, investigated overnight, tried quickly at the break of dawn, and Jesus is on the cross by 9 a.m. I mean, the next morning. After 6 hours of agony, he's dead by 3 p.m. The whole thing happens so quickly and is clearly in violation of their own rules. This is not justice. This is equivalent to a gang execution. Now, notice, I just found this significant. Through all this injustice, this mistreatment and abuse, Jesus never retaliates with sin himself. This is our tendency. We respond to sin with sin. We respond in kind. We justify our behavior by looking at the behavior of others and saying, well, they did that, and so they deserved this in kind. But Jesus never gave himself up to a victim mentality. He didn't strike back in anger. He doesn't retaliate. He doesn't treat people in kind. He never falls into that trap that we so easily do. So Jesus, they get him to say what they want him to say and admit that he is the Christ, so they're going to use this against him. So they take him to Pilate, chapter 23, verse 1. Then the whole company of them arose and brought him before Pilate, and they began to accuse him, saying, "We found this man misleading our nation, forbidding us to give tribute to Caesar, and saying that he himself is Christ, a king." Pilate asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And he answered him, "You have said so." Then Pilate said to the chief priests and the crowds, "I find no guilt in this man." But they were urgent, saying, "He stirs up the people, teaching throughout all Judea from Galilee even to this place." When Pilate heard this, he asked whether the man was a Galilean. And when he learned that he belonged to Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him over to Herod, who himself was in Jerusalem at that time. The seat of Roman power in the region is in Caesarea, but conveniently, Pilate happens to be in town for the big Passover feast. It's a time of heightened nationalistic zeal, so it's good to be present for this. And Pilate, as representative of Caesar, he alone has the authority to execute capital punishment. Now, the charges that have been brought forward are, at first, they've been changed from religious ones, "Are you the Christ?" to political ones. They've translated into political charges against Christ. First, they've charged him with misleading the people. In other words, seducing them away from loyalty to Rome. Secondly, opposing payment of taxes to Caesar. And thirdly, claiming to be a true king instead of Caesar. And Pilate ignores the first two as silly and focuses in on the third. "Are you the king of the Jews?" Jesus responds by affirming it. Now, there's certainly more to the questioning and the back and forth. But Pilate, after investigating, concludes that Jesus and his disciples pose no threat to Roman authority. And he says, "I find no guilt in this man." And this gets declared over and over in this chapter. Luke wants to drill it into our minds that Jesus is without guilt. He is innocent. He's completely innocent. And they're unable to find anything to charge him with. But the Jewish leaders are urgent, and they're throwing around accusations. And in the process of doing this, they let it be known that Jesus is from Galilee, and most of his ministry has been in Galilee. Upon learning this, Pilate finding an opportunity to get rid of this case and have nothing to do with it, he sends Jesus off to Herod, who's the puppet king for Rome over Galilee. So even though Pilate has more authority, he wants to pass this off to Herod and have nothing to do with this. Now, conveniently, Herod also happens to be in town for the feast. And so off to Herod he goes. Verse 8, when Herod saw Jesus, he was very glad, for he had long desired to see him because he had heard about him, and he was hoping to see some sign done by him. So he questioned him at some length, but he made no answer. The chief priests and the scribes stood by vehemently accusing him, and Herod with his soldiers treated him with contempt and mocked him. Then arraying him in splendid clothing, he sent him back to Pilate. And Herod and Pilate became friends with each other that very day, for before this they had been at enmity with each other. So Herod's not really interested in the case as much as he is in Jesus. He's heard stories about Jesus. He's heard about miraculous signs. He's hoping maybe he'll get to see something himself. Maybe Jesus will put on a little personal show for him. Herod questions him for a while, but all the while, Jesus makes no defense for himself. He makes no response. And this just riles up the chief priests and scribes, and they vehemently accuse him. And meanwhile, both Herod and the soldiers treat Jesus with contempt. They're abusing him, mocking him. They dress him up as a king in mockery. Look at the king. But they find Jesus guilty of nothing, and Herod sends him back to Pilate. It's interesting because up to this point, we're told that Pilate and Herod had been in conflict. They did not get along at all. But this shared experience actually brings them together, and they become friends. The irony is rich, right? Jesus' mistrial and suffering brings reconciliation between such enemies as Pilate and Herod. Even here, Jesus is reconciling enemies. Even in this moment, he's bringing together parties that would never otherwise be reconciled. But in the end, Herod can find nothing wrong. He's not guilty of anything. That's two rulers now who, upon investigation, declare that Jesus is innocent of any crime. And so back to Pilate we go. Verse 13. Pilate then called together the chief priests and the rulers and the people and said to them, "You brought me this man as one who is misleading the people. And after examining him before you, behold, I did not find this man guilty of any of your charges against him. Neither did Herod, for he sent him back to us. Look, nothing deserving death has been done by him. I will therefore punish and release him." So Pilate speaking to everyone now, the whole crowd, it's now public. You've brought forward this accusation that Jesus is misleading people and stirring them up to rebellion. But after this legal investigation, I found these charges to be baseless and false. Herod also finds him innocent. He's done nothing deserving of death. So I'll give him a beating and release him. The one thing that Luke really seems to be hammering home through all these events is that Jesus is innocent. Jesus is innocent. Nobody can find anything wrong. Even under the pressures of this growing mob, many vehement accusations from religious leaders that have significant influence, neither Herod nor Pilate are able, though they want to, though they try, to find anything to charge him with. I mean, this is not the easy treatment of friends. I mean, they're more than willing to beat him, mock him, mistreat him, and abuse him, but try as they might, they're unable to find anything to charge him with. He's not guilty of anything. I'm trying to picture this, and I mean, imagine with me that you're on trial like this, that there's a wide number of people who are doing everything they can to find something, anything that they can charge you with. And they're not interested in justice. They're interested in nailing you. What would they find? What would they accuse you of? What would they say about you? Imagine it. Picture it. If they did their very best to dig up, what happens when you move the rocks? What's hiding underneath? What would they say? "I did not find the person guilty of any of these charges." What would they find if they dug? What charges would they bring forward? Now, throughout Luke's telling of Jesus' trial, there seems to be many allusions over and over to Isaiah chapter 53, that famous passage about the suffering servant who dies as an offering for the salvation of the people. There's parallels on Jesus' mistreatment. In Isaiah 53, the suffering servant is said to be despised and rejected, oppressed, afflicted, wounded, and crushed. We see parallels on Jesus' silence before his accusers. Isaiah 53 says that he opened not his mouth. And here we see Jesus refusing to give a reply. And we see parallels on Jesus' innocence. In Isaiah 53:9, it says that he had done no violence and there was no deceit in his mouth. And he is called by God, the righteous one, my servant. So you see these over and over again allusions and parallels. Jesus is the innocent, suffering servant, giving his life as an offering for sin. Now, watch how it plays out. Verse 18. But they all cried out together, "Away with this man," and released to us Barabbas, a man who had been thrown into prison for an insurrection and started in the city, and for murder. Pilate addressed them once more, desiring to release Jesus, but they kept shouting, "Crucify, crucify him." A third time he said to them, "Why, what evil has he done? I have found in him no guilt deserving death. I will therefore punish and release him." But they were urgent, demanding with loud cries that he should be crucified, and their voices prevailed. So Pilate decided that their demand should be granted. He released the man who had been thrown into prison for insurrection and murder, for whom they asked, but he delivered Jesus over to their will. So Pilate just wants to beat him and release him, hoping that the public humiliation and the beating, the shaming of Jesus would meet the satisfaction of the Jewish leadership and their mob. This is an honor and shame culture, so shaming him this way would be a significant thing. But they're not satisfied, and they're going to settle for nothing less than Jesus' death. Three times, Pilate pleads with him that Jesus is innocent of any crimes, does not deserve death. It would be injustice to have him killed, but they will not relent. Now, in many ways, Pilate is a conflicted character, isn't he? He's caught in an awful situation. He has an innocent man and an angry mob. He's in Jerusalem, a city known for rebellions and conflict, at the Passover festival, where the city is bursting at the seams with people and bursting at the seams with nationalistic zeal. This is a hard situation. Yes, yet he alone holds authority. He alone chooses to have an innocent man killed. And he intentionally orders a miscarriage of justice. And so he's forever remembered in our creeds. Jesus was crucified under Pontius Pilate. He'll forever be remembered. He alone had the decision to make, and he chose injustice over justice. Now, there was a tradition, we learn, where Pilate would release to them one prisoner at the Passover, any one that they chose. Perhaps this was just an appeasement to kind of keep the populace on his side, keep people happy with him. Usually the people would choose a hero who was caught and convicted by Rome for stirring up a revolt or causing trouble. So this person would be an enemy of Rome, but sort of a friend of the people, kind of a almost like a Robin Hood character. You know, it's like he's causing trouble for their enemies. And so the people love him and Rome doesn't. And so usually that's the type of person. And Pilate, this time, he's trying to find a way out, and he offers to release to them Jesus. Certainly he was a local hero, well-liked by the people. Perhaps he could be the prisoner that they released, and in that way he would get to release him and keep the crowd happy. He's trying to find a way to make this work, but it doesn't. Stirred up by the Jewish leaders, the crowd demands that Pilate release Barabbas instead, who is a known insurrectionist and murderer. There's just filled with great hypocrisy. They're demanding that innocent Jesus be killed, accused of being a revolutionary, while demanding the freedom of an actual revolutionary who's actually been found guilty. Also, the priests are demanding that Jesus be killed on the accusation that he was attempting to overthrow the political authorities, yet they themselves are refusing to submit to the political authorities and are even subtly threatening Pilate if he doesn't comply. There's a loud and large angry mob that's demanding things of those who are in authority over them. And so they demand the release of they demand the murder of an innocent man and the release of a known murderer. Who's the real troublemakers for Rome? Is it really Jesus? Doesn't sound like he's causing trouble at all. It's this parallel because Barabbas is everything that Jesus was wrongly accused of, right? He's an actual revolutionary, an actual insurrectionist, a known murderer. And Luke intentionally contrasts these two. The very guilty, very evil man, Barabbas, who's a real threat, and the completely innocent man, Jesus, who's wrongly accused. And the guilt of Barabbas is laid against the innocence of Jesus to reveal the massive injustice of the cross. And then there's this exchange. It's just amazing. There's this exchange of Barabbas for Jesus. And it's this vivid picture of the gospel. I hope you see the gospel sitting here, acted out for us. One man is evil. He's been tried. He's been found guilty. He deserves punishment, even death. The cross was typically reserved for people like this, insurrectionists and murderers. The other is truly righteous, has been tried and has been found to be innocent, and deserves only blessing and reward, not punishment. The one who deserves death is set free. His sentence is just ended, and he's released, his life restored. To his great surprise, he receives that which he does not deserve, life, freedom. The one who deserves life, blessing, reward, is given instead the sentence of death, and his life is taken. He receives the punishment that was earned by the other man. The sentence of the one gets put on the other. The reward of the one gets put on the other. The guilty one walks free. The innocent one is killed. This, don't you see, is the good news of the gospel. It's shocking. It's backwards. It feels all wrong. And this is the good news. You walk free and are in fact rewarded, given forgiveness, reconciliation, and life, though you deserve the cross. Jesus goes to the cross and is rewarded with shame and suffering and death, though he deserves life. Do you see the amazement of the gospel enacted for us in this exchange? Now, over the years, people have often argued and questioned and said, well, who's to blame for all this? Who's to blame for Jesus' death? Is it the Jewish leaders who arrested him, accused him, and demanded his death? What about the crowd for joining in, intimidating Pilate into sentencing Jesus against Pilate's own convictions? Maybe it's Pilate. I mean, ultimately, it was one man's decision. He alone could give the sentence of death, and he did it. He's responsible for it. Was it Herod? Who is to blame? Well, we read Acts chapter 2, verse 22 to 23. Peter, preaching to the crowds in Jerusalem on Pentecost, says this: Men of Israel, hear these words. Jesus of Nazareth, a man attested to you by God with mighty works and wonders and signs that God did through him in your midst, as you yourselves know, this Jesus delivered up according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God, you crucified and killed by the hands of lawless men. And then in Acts 4, the disciples are together and they're praying to God, and this is how they pray. They say, for truly in this city there were gathered together against your holy servant Jesus, whom you anointed, both Herod and Pontius Pilate, along with the Gentiles and the peoples of Israel, to do whatever your hand and your plan had predestined to take place. You see, what the disciples see as they look back and they understand what happened is they see that everyone is responsible. All the parties are held responsible. Pilate, Herod, the Gentiles, the peoples of Israel, as they talk to the crowd, you did this, and the lawless men that actually drove the nails. Everyone is culpable. Everyone is responsible for their sin, for their evil. And yet, at the same time, the murder of Jesus was part of the plan of God. It was, as they say, according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God. It was the evil acts of Herod, Pilate, the Gentiles, and the Israelites were, as they say, whatever your hand and your plan had predestined to take place. So while this in no way removes their guilt, the culpability of those who have done evil, ultimately, the death of Jesus was central to the eternal plan of God the Father. The death of Jesus was not a tragic end. It was not surprising to the Father. Didn't see that coming. It wasn't the surprise ending. It was the plan all along. Revelation chapter 13, verse 8, John is describing the people who won't and don't worship the beast. And he describes them this way. It says, And all who dwell on earth will worship it, the beast. Everyone whose name has not been written before the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb that was slain. This is a fascinating little verse here. Before the foundation of the world, this is what we learn. Before the foundation of the world, there was a book. This book has names in it. Names that God wrote down. Names of people who will be faithful to God and who won't worship the beast, who won't flee from God and redirect their worship away from God, but to something else. And this book has a name, and the name of the book is the book of the life of the Lamb that was slain. So think about this. Before God made anything, before the foundation of the world, before the beginning, he had a plan for the saving of many accomplished through the slaughter of the Lamb, his son. Before Adam and Eve, before sin was a reality, before sin was a possibility, God had already planned the cross, and he'd written down the names of those he would save by the blood of the Lamb. God's not reacting. He's initiating all along. This was God's plan from before Genesis 1:1, to glorify his grace, to display his mercy through the slaughter of the Lamb that would save many. God had already planned this, the cross, well before all of this. So while many hold blame, ultimately, the death of Jesus is the plan of God for the saving of many. We already saw Luke alluding to Isaiah 53 and the suffering servant. And there, Isaiah writes that of the suffering servant saying, it was the will of the Lord to crush him. And then it says that his soul will make an offering for sin. See, Jesus wasn't murdered as much as he poured out his soul to death. This is the language not of tragedy or injustice, but of sacrifice, of offering, of a gift. See? The trial of Jesus just makes clear over and over again that Jesus is innocent of all charges. Now, at various times, we know what this feels like to some degree. We feel like we've been treated unjustly, right? This week, I bought a lawnmower, and I opened it up, and it was missing a part, a very, very crucial part that made it entirely useless. Man, what suffering. I was mistreated. It was unjust. I'm owed better. I'm furious. How dare they? We feel like we're mistreated. And yet, you know, and we might suffer unjustly. It happens. But none of us can claim complete innocence, because Jesus alone is the truly innocent sufferer. He's truly innocent of all charges. He suffers not for wrongdoing, but as Isaiah 53 repeats, listen to these words, the Lord has laid on him the iniquity, sin, evil, wrongdoing of us all. He was wounded for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquity. He shall bear their iniquities. He bore the sin of many. Over and over and over again, it's repeated. Jesus was perfectly innocent, but he did suffer greatly not for his crimes, but for ours. Be amazed at the beautiful exchange of the gospel. My sin for Jesus' righteousness. There will be a day of justice when all will stand before God and give an account. And as Phil Ryken puts it this way, he says, through faith in Jesus Christ, when you at last appear before the throne of God, justly accused of all your sin, Jesus will plead the merits of his own royal and innocent righteousness. Having suffered for your sins all the way to the cross, he will speak up and tell his Father not to give you the verdict that you deserve, but the verdict that he deserves. See, Jesus suffers what I deserve, and I'm gifted what he deserves in his complete innocence, his perfect righteousness. Do you see how this is so different than like religious obedience, right? Religion says keep the rules, do the right thing, be good, perform well, behave, and God will reward you. It's performance that earns relationship. And instead, contradiction to all that, the gospel says Jesus kept the rules. Jesus always did the right thing. Jesus was perfectly righteous. Jesus was innocent and good for you. So leave behind your self-reliance, your self-salvation project that you've been working on. Throw yourself instead at the mercy of Jesus, trusting the beautiful exchange of the gospel as your only hope. You can stand before God and plead your innocence based on your performance, which I would not recommend. Or you can stand before God knowing your guilt, but pleading mercy based on Jesus' innocence and his performance, which I would highly recommend. And so we look at the gospel and we need to be amazed and respond to what Jesus has done for us. He was innocent and he suffered in your place. Let's pray. God, we thank you. Oh, we thank you so much. We thank you for the cross. We thank you that we see these stories unfold and cry out injustice and look at the evil and the horror of it. And yet you had this plan. It was all in your hands from before the beginning. And you're working this for your great glory and for the glory of the grace of the gospel, for the saving of many. I just pray that as we consider your words, as we consider the gospel, that you would show us our guilt, that we are not innocent, and that you would have the gospel deeply penetrate our hearts, that we would truly come to know and understand and fully believe that because of the cross, we are declared innocent, not based on our performance, but based on yours. That we are clothed in the perfect righteousness of Jesus. They tried him, they brought him before courts, and they did their very best, but could find nothing to accuse him of. They could find no way to charge him rightly. We are dressed in the righteousness of Christ by faith. And he gets dressed in our guilt and shame, taking it to the cross, suffering in our place. We thank you for this beautiful exchange. I pray that that truth would settle deep in our hearts. It would shape our thoughts and life and worship. And may we enjoy you and glorify you in response to the exchange of the gospel. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.